Are you troubled by strange hockey trades in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread about NHL free agency?
Have you or your family ever seen a New York Islanders game?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Pick up your mobile device and subscribe to Lighthouse Hockey Podcast from SB Nation today.
Our courteous and efficient hosts are ready to serve all of your Islander needs and worries.
Lighthouse Hockey Podcasts for New York Islanders fans.
Ahoy, motherfuckers. It's Amazing Avenue Audio, the show. I am Brian. With me, as always, is Chris. And it's funny. I actually spoke with a former host slash fellow Mets podcaster, Jeffrey Paternostro, and he was going to start his show off with salutations, motherfuckers. So I said I would do ahoy in solidarity. we're here to talk about the unbelievable shit show that has been the last week of the Mets season. Chris, we've lived through a lot of bad Mets stuff.
We have.
We've written and podcasted about a lot of bad Mets stuff. Is this the pure worst PR week in your Mets fandom?
So it might be recency bias. I'd say yes is my gut answer to that. There have been some other bad ones.
Tony Bernazard?
Yeah, Bernazard, Beltran's knee surgery, Havlabi. What else? Like ones that I really remember. I feel like any of the Bobby Valentine stuff, and Matt Callen wrote about it so well in his book, and we were all old enough to at least have pretty good memories of it at the time. I don't know that any of that stood out in that kind of way. There was no Bobby Valentine equivalent of the fried chicken thing in Boston, you know?
Right, right.
So it sure feels like the worst. If I add a disclaimer, purely from the Mets playing baseball perspective, the Jose Reyes situation was probably worse. In terms of how it felt, the fact that he was brought back, the fact that he was so bad on the field, all of that maybe was something that had a longer lasting impact on people. But on the baseball side, yeah, I wasn't old enough to have like a real knowledge of or memory of the Saberhagen thing,
right?
The Vince Coleman, that whole super contentious interaction with the public and the media and all that. So, yeah, I would rank it up there, given all of those parameters. I think it's about the worst. It's just Terry Collins would say things, Jerry Manuel would say things, Willie Randolph would say things, but I don't think any of them said them as consistently, and none of them got to a point that everything did with Mickey Callaway on Sunday, and yeah, that's where we are.
Well, I have a sub question for you.
All right.
Which is, has there ever been a time, let's just call it in our time at Amazing Avenue, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Where the Wilpons were not the biggest joke of the week in Metsville? This is the first time that somebody who's not a Wilpon has done something this egregiously bad.
Yeah, I think this rises to the level of Fred Wilpon with the David Wright infamous interview. He's not a superstar.
Yeah.
All that. This is on that level. And again, baseball or strictly the operational side of things, the story about the lawsuit filed against the Mets and Jeff Wilpon for his behavior with Lee Castorine, I'm blanking a little bit on the pronunciation of her full last name, but that was probably the moment that stood out the most in between Not a Superstar and now. But even that was a pretty decent time ago. So,
and that was to me, like, while I vehemently disagree with what Fred Wilpon said, and it was super clueless to say it, it wasn't. It was clearly his opinion that you could disagree with. It was somebody expressing an unpopular opinion. It's not lashing out at a reporter.
Yeah, it wasn't.
He wasn't trying to, like, pick a fight with somebody.
Right. And it wasn't crossing a line. David Wright is still very loyal, very much a part of the fabric of the Mets. How much he's involved on any regular basis, we don't really know, but he's there. It didn't cause a rift or anything. It was just sort of a thing that fans got to make fun of and continue to make fun of, and rightfully so, and all that. But yeah,
I don't know. This seems to me like the absolute worst Mets PR week. And for once, like I said, it's not the fault of the Wilpons necessarily. I also think that there should be a distinction made here between the incident that happened on Sunday and the reaction to it on Monday. You know, to borrow a legal term, Sunday seemed like a crime of passion.
Mm-hmm.
Where everybody was just at their wit's end and people reacted poorly. And while it's not excusable in any circumstance to threaten somebody else, especially in a work environment, I think we've all been at the end of our rope and we've said things we maybe wish we didn't say. That is a world of difference than what Callaway and Vargas did on Monday, which was fail to apologize for what happened. And Callaway specifically being asked if he was sorry and him dancing around it so conspicuously and then, you know, and then having to call a second press conference. I mean, just absolutely insane. You know, I can't remember anything like that ever happening before. Just so terrible.
Right. Yeah. It's not to dip into, oh, I tweeted this thing, but as this is going on, as soon as I see that the reporters have been called back into, you know, the room or his office or whatever, they've been called back in so he can readdress the situation, my mind immediately jumps to Larry David wondering whether or not his apology is good enough.
Yep.
And then saying, if I fuck up the apology, I'll apologize for the bad apology.
Yeah.
and Jeff's response to him in that conversation is like, what? No. You get one shot. You can't do it again. But that somehow that's where the Mets wound up. I just don't know. And the organization overall is not radically different. Obviously, somebody else is in charge with Jay Horowitz transitioning to the alumni role, you know, retiring from that intense day to day, being with the team all the time, that kind of thing. And I don't know, maybe give some perspective to that job, that whether or not somebody's doing that exceptionally well or pretty well or, you know, average or below, there's only so much you can control in prepping the guy who's going to go out there and speak.
Yeah.
So yeah. It would apply to Fred Wilpon several years back, and it certainly applies to Callaway here. I can't imagine that there was a group of people who spoke with him and concluded, oh, yeah, just say that's private. It's between me and him. That'll work. Bring up Billy Martin. That'll work. I don't know. I do. Actually, one of the things I'm most curious about with that whole process is whether or not Mickey Callaway got home that night and was just pissed off and like, it's out there and I can't go to sleep. And he goes on the internet and just Googles like worst things baseball manager. And then sifts through and goes, oh, Billy Martin punched a reporter one time. Okay, that's what I'm going to use. But I want to know if that was from him, if it was somebody, a friend or family member who happened to remember that that was the thing and mentioned it to him. I want to know how between Sunday night and Monday that little tidbit got into his head. And it's entirely possible that he just remembered reading about it and knew it was a thing and was keeping it in his back pocket.
For when he inevitably fucked up his manager.
Right. But yeah, that's, it's kind of fascinating how that came out. And getting back to the point with the PR staff and dealing with the folks who are facing the public and the press and everything, you just can only do so much. As much as I think the Mets have a lot of issues with getting messaging straight and all that, and we saw it certainly on a different scale, but we saw it with Terry Collins, we saw it with managers before him, where the player, the manager, the GM, and some unnamed source from the organization, any combination of them might have a different answer to something that's the same. But I don't know. Maybe it kind of just speaks to in some part to the difficulty of it. I'm not trying to make excuses for the team, but maybe it's just Mickey Callaway is so much who he is that you couldn't get him to say something that made sense.
I just.
But it's the most basic thing. Just say, either publicly say, I apologize to the team, my players, the front office, our fans. I reacted poorly. And then instead he went with the whole, I can control my reaction. I can't control what somebody else said to me. And he said that a few times, and I'm sitting there like, what?
That's what I tell my 7-year-old all the time.
Right. So who's, yeah.
I'm not joking. That's like literally my sagely fatherhood advice. Like, you can't control what others say to you, but you can control how you treat them. And that's, and that's appropriate life advice for me to give to a 7-year-old. You should already know that by the time you are an adult. And that shouldn't be, everything about this is so unbelievably backwards. I mean, again, just the fact that Jeff Wilpon issued an apology and called Tim Healy himself on Sunday night, the fact that Jeff Wilpon has the moral high ground in any conversation is flabbergasting.
It speaks to the situation that the team had a statement and that he made a personal phone call to apologize and they did it quickly.
Yes.
I mean,
it's flabbergasting, right?
Yeah.
But sort of even beyond that, just the idea that Callaway had to know from jump, like, I'm going to have to talk to the press about this. I can't say no, unless I'm getting fired right now. I can't just no comment this away, right? I have to say something to somebody about this relatively soon. And so he had to have thought, or somebody must have said to him, hey, have you thought about how you're going to answer this question when it inevitably comes up? And either he didn't think about that, or he just totally whiffed in the moment. You know, like when you're saying to yourself, like, don't say whatever, don't say whatever, don't say whatever. And then you come out and this is the first thing you say. Like maybe he legitimately just fucked it up and was trying to apologize and didn't. But it just seemed to me like the overall tone of Callaway and Vargas was, we're not sorry. You might want us to say we're sorry, and we'll say what we have to say to keep our jobs, but ultimately, we are not sorry for this. We do not feel like we did anything wrong here. And there's a difference between getting angry and having righteous anger and whatever you want to say, and not thinking that you were wrong, like, not thinking your position was wrong, but admitting that what you did was wrong. That your actions were not what they should have been. And if you can't make a distinction between those things, then I feel like you're not an adult. Which of us hasn't apologized for something at our jobs that wasn't our fault? Just to move the conversation along. Yeah. Right? I mean, don't we do that all the time at work? Right. I mean, it's just it's part of adulthood, you know. You eat shit for something you didn't do because it keeps the peace and it moves everything along. It's just what you do sometimes at your job, and I don't understand how Callaway doesn't get that. And I think that Vargas, Vargas was more in the wrong. Vargas physically threatened Healy, and that is worse than just calling him a motherfucker. I think we can all agree with that. But I'll say this. Vargas is not as media trained, nor is he expected to speak for the entire team in the way that Callaway is. Callaway's entire job when speaking to the press is to represent the organization. Even when he's answering questions about what he did during a game, he is filtering that through this understanding that I have to represent the organization as well as I can here. And the fact that every day he has to do this and he's not better at this is sad, I guess. But more than all of that, and this is the thing I feel like I'm not seeing enough people talking about, even if you don't believe that cursing at a reporter is a terrible thing, even if you don't believe that Callaway and Vargas deserve to be suspended for their actions, I don't see how this can put any confidence in you about how Callaway is going to deal with adversity in the future. You know, the excuse for this was that, well, it's close quarters in Chicago and it was a devastating loss. Okay. That doesn't excuse you from acting the way you did. And I think that if a beat reporter doing his job is enough to get you to flip your lid, then what's going to happen if you run into real adversity during the season?
Yeah. And one of the details that has been maybe not focused on, but it's been a thing that people have talked about, wondering, oh, how did he say it? What was the context? How did he say it? What did it sound like in person and all that? And pretty much everything that we've heard from colleagues who are in the room was that it wasn't said in some overly sarcastic way and all that. I can picture it in my head, and you know, I haven't spoken to Tim Healy for more than a couple minutes in total ever, so I don't know him well enough to make any specific assumptions. But after that press conference in the post game, I could see it being maybe like a little snarky, not in a way that at all warranted any of the responses that it got.
Right.
But it clashed a little bit in the press conference and then be like, see you tomorrow, Mickey. Just a little, not like people had talked about, oh, does Callaway interpret it that he's insinuating he might not be there tomorrow and all that. I think that was taking it a little too far. I can just see, or I can imagine hearing just a little bit of that. We didn't get along. We'll be back here tomorrow doing the same thing. And
well,
that's
kind of the way I took it, was just, you know, if you're not going to answer this for me today, well, then I'll see you tomorrow when I'm asked the same question again. You know?
Yeah.
But ultimately, if it was said sarcastically, that's still not an excuse for what he did.
Right. Oh, yeah. No, not at all.
And I know you're not saying that. I'm just, just reinforcing that. Yeah.
Right. And I guess I wonder if that exchange happened and Calloway just flipped him off and smiled, I don't think we would have heard about it at all. I really don't. I also wonder if we would have heard about it if it was just Calloway, if Vargas hadn't taken a step or two toward him, or wherever that exactly was finalized, if he hadn't moved in his direction and said what he said. That certainly made it newsworthy. So if Calloway hears it and just flips him off and keeps walking, I don't think any reporter would have put that out there and said anything of it. And no. It could have conveyed the same message without throwing a tantrum.
Hey, I'm Spencer Hall.
I'm Holly Anderson.
I'm Ryan Nanny.
I'm Jason Kirk, and we're the hosts of the Shutdown Fullcast, your Avengers of College Football podcast. It says here in the script I'm to riff on what that means, and basically what I mean is it's all already spoiled.
Every Tuesday, we talk about everything from cooking disasters to pro wrestling to unfashionable pants we wore in middle school.
We also do talk about college football every now and then, like mascot fights, announcers fleeing the booth early, and unfashionable pants that coaches wear now.
If you want to take college football exactly as seriously as it should be taken, subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app.
Hi, I'm Avery Truffleman, and I'm hosting Curb's new podcast, Nice Try. It's stories about how people have tried to design a better world and what happens when those designs don't go according to plan. Season one is called Utopian, and it's about the perpetual search for the perfect place. It includes cannibalism, fascist architecture, polyamory, hermetically sealed domes, and Kourtney Kardashian's dining room chairs. But, you know, not necessarily in that order. New episodes of Nice Try come out every Thursday. Subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app.
And I want to preface this. I have not spent any time in a major league clubhouse. I am talking out my ass here. But I would imagine that, like a lot of sort of, more casual work environments, I'm sure people swear relatively frequently in a clubhouse. And I'm sure that the manager has a good enough relationship with certain reporters to say, like, haha, fuck you. Or, something along those lines, right? Where it's not, where the tone is clearly indicating that you're not angry, but you're using a word that can be used in an angry situation, right? I'm sure that, maybe if not Calloway, I'm sure there are managers out there who have that relationship with certain members of the press. I always got the impression that that Terry Collins had that kind of relationship with some members of the press.
Oh, yeah. I can I'm comfortable with saying that. I didn't make it down to spring training this year, but last year was Terry's first having been relieved of managerial duties, but still being an advisor within the organization. And Calloway was in his first spring training as manager. And there was a conversation with Collins that involved another staffer or two from the Mets. And I just happened to be there on that field at that time. And the conversation itself was off the record, but I can say the language, he wasn't shy. He was really good at not swearing when he was in his on the record, on camera, in front of reporters.
Right,
mode.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. But he could handle that distinction well. And yeah, he knows how to say all those other words.
And I'm sure that they've been said in non-confrontational ways to him and by him to members of the press many times.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you had called this like back I think it was last spring training, or maybe early in the season.
Yeah, it was that same spring training trip because I had just gone in for one of the spring training post game pressers.
And you had said to me, I don't know if you said it on the show or just to me, in conversation, that you felt like Callaway was maybe, how would you describe it? What did you say? Like you could see him having an outburst. You could see him getting upset. Like, how did you phrase it? I can't remember exactly how you phrased it.
Yeah, I think it was, I don't think it was specifically an outburst, but it was just sort of a disproportionate response to a question given the circumstances. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened here. The circumstances were just much more significant. So I have no recollection of what the specifics were, but it was some series of questions from the beat reporters to him following a spring training game and why he did this or why he did that. And he just got that little bit of something. To his answers.
A little bit indignant, maybe, or a little bit defensive?
Yeah. A little bit of that, I'd say defensive and also combined with superiority. Mm-hmm. It didn't shock me that this eventually happened. It was just a... It was a weird vibe. I don't know if it was picked up on TV in the same way that I noticed it there. I've got a scratchy throat. Hold on. Sure.
I think you definitely see that in some of his pressers, and I want to somewhat shift the conversation forward here because people smarter than us have talked about this a lot, and while I'm sure our insights are invaluable and appreciated by everybody, I do want to look a little bit forward here. I think a lot of other organizations would have fired Callaway that night and would have gotten no brush back from it. I think that other organizations would have fired him after his non-apology on Monday and gotten no brush back from it. Callaway is still the Mets manager. They have now lost 3 games in a row to Philadelphia, who lost 7 games in a row before they played them. Lost tonight's game in very frustrating fashion to Jay Bruce walk-off double. The bullpen blew yet another game. Is there any conceivable way that Callaway finishes this season as Mets manager?
I guess I would say yes, just if they want to say, we're going to leave it in place, ride this season out, whatever, and then fire him at the end of the season. But let's see if I could be more specifically prophetic in this case. I said at some point in pizza on Monday evening, I guess.
Pizza, by the way, is one of the Amazing Avenue Slack channels, just for those listening.
Yeah, to quote one of my favorite Jerry Seinfeld lines from the show, oh, it's a scene, man.
Yes. Yes, it is.
But in that conversation, it had to be Monday evening because they had had the whole outburst and threats and all that on Sunday night. And then Monday during the day, press conference part one, Monday evening, press conference part two. And I think that was around the time that I said, would it be the most Mets thing ever to not fire him last night or today and then have the Mets get, I forget if I said get swept, but they're 3/4 of the way there, but get swept or have a terrible series in Philadelphia and then fire him at the end of the 4-game series where you were so close to getting it right with what happened in Chicago and the next day, but you also come off as firing him for not that reason. I mean, if they lose again, whether listeners are hearing this before or after this game on Thursday afternoon, if they lose again, this was as miserable a road trip as everybody thought it might be.
Yeah.
And strictly from a baseball perspective, you could fire Callaway at that point. But then you just have this awkward, well, why did you fire him now? Why didn't you do it 3 days ago?
Well, you know, I think I have an answer to that.
Okay.
I think what the Wilpons would say is that we're not firing him for what he did. We're firing him for baseball reasons. And so on Sunday night, they split a series with a first place team over the course of a weekend, almost won 3 or 4. Theoretically, you could say they could have swept the series. Like, he wasn't managing bad baseball on Sunday night. No matter what happened, he wasn't managing bad baseball. Then he managed bad baseball for 4 days, and now we're firing him.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that's a good reason.
Right.
But I could see it happening.
Yeah. And I guess to some extent they could kind of go, it's the cumulative body of work.
Sure.
I mean, usually when you fire somebody, you don't get into too many details until you leak it to somebody in the press like a month later.
Right.
So I wouldn't expect a full essay on it, but they could frame it in the sense of the performance wasn't there. We had to discipline him. That's, even though for the amount of money they're making, it's not that much of a fine. At least there's a record that the team did discipline these guys in some way. So they could basically frame it as baseball is the top priority. It's not going as well as we want. And also, obviously, there were other factors that came into play and make it sort of a balanced thing. But I don't know. If you weren't going to fire him early this week, I think you kind of have to get to the end of the season and then do it and say, this was a disappointing season, which right now I don't think anybody expects anything other than that. It was a disappointing season. We've parted ways with Mickey. We're going to give Brody a chance to hire a new manager. We're going to do the most thorough search. Only the best people. Sorry.
Oh, boy. There go our mentions.
But, yeah, I don't know. There's no stronger commitment. A few weeks ago when he was almost fired or about to be fired, according to some reports, and they had I didn't think it was that awkward. I thought it actually got painted as being a little more awkward than it was. But Van Wagenen comes out and says, we have confidence in him. He's our guy and everything. And he wouldn't specifically say he'll definitely be here till the end of the season.
I think he said something like for the foreseeable future.
Right. I thought that may have actually gotten blown up a little bit too much based on what he had said. But if that was clearly that moment didn't break that feeling that they were going to keep him around. So if Sunday night and Monday afternoon didn't do it, then I don't see how you can fire him until the season's over and you have a conclusion on how poorly it went. That doesn't mean I don't think they should. It doesn't mean I think it's the best thing, but that's ultimately why I said, hey, this might be the most Mets way to handle it. Don't fire him at a moment when everybody, pretty much, except for, I think, a handful of people, would have been like, okay, yep, yeah, you can't do that. That was a messed up thing for him to do. I'm on board. And then just wait a few days and do it then. So, I don't know. Nothing would surprise me at this point, but I think you'd leave him. Just leave him there. Let him. Somebody also, another pizza reference here. There's more pizza than I like to share on the podcast normally.
Yeah.
But it's all good. But somebody had said maybe the punishment is leaving him there.
Yeah. That's good. So I don't think we know how much Mickey Callaway makes a season, do we?
I don't recall it being specifically mentioned.
Oh, wait, hang on. Maybe it is here.
Maybe in the range of 1.5 to 2 million, something like that. If I'm guessing, I think Terry was making a little more than that.
Mickey Callaway is making $850,000 this year.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
All right. So half of the lower end of my estimate.
Okay, so...
Which, to be clear, still a really good salary.
Absolutely.
But...
You or I would be very happy to get that salary.
Yeah, I don't think there's a job in baseball that I would turn down for that salary.
Exactly. Yeah. So Callaway and Vargas were suspended. Were fined $10,000 apiece for this incident. For Vargas, that is the equivalent. If you take Vargas's contract and you figure out the percentage of it, the $10,000 is, and then you apply that to $50,000, which what is going to use as like a median middle class salary. Okay, $50,000. That's the equivalent of a $64 fine.
Yeah,
for the year. For Callaway, obviously, it's a little bit different than that because Callaway is making a tenth, a little bit less than a tenth of what Vargas is making this year. But still, that means that it's equivalent of, you know, it is really not a substantial. It's not a substantial fine. And my question with all of this is if the organization is giving the impression that you can do this and not have your livelihood affected in any major way, do you think that we're going to see more of this, or is the embarrassment factor such that just no one's going to pull this shit again? This is the parent in me coming out again here, right? We're like, when my kids do something wrong, I have to make sure to put the punishment there to make sure they don't do it again. You know, that's the whole point of a punishment, is that they learn from it. And I don't know if this number is particularly troubling.
Yeah, that's true. I know when Gary Cohen spoke about it during the game tonight, he had mentioned that, at least in the case of Vargas, because of the Players Association, that might have been the maximum fine they could do without getting into grievances and drawing it out and making it a whole thing. So I get that.
But the team could have suspended him.
Yeah, that was also an option. I don't know. I think the embarrassment is probably more of a deterrent than the money in either case. You would hope.
Yeah.
At the very least, I would think everybody who's in the room for those things and then saw the aftermath would kind of have that in their head.
Yeah.
You know what? It's not worth it. You know, the old cliche about picking a fight with somebody who buys ink by the barrel.
Right.
In this case, somebody who puts pixels on screens. I don't know the best way to put it, but yeah, just don't do that. I mean, it's not even specific to the press side of it. Just be a decent person in a workplace and don't treat people like shit.
Yeah. These novel ideas that we have, Chris. So I did a guest spot yesterday on SB Nation Radio for a show that is a general sports talk show. And usually when I'm called for these things, like last year when the Harvey thing happened, I think both of us, you know, got lots of questions about appearing on places to talk about, you know, the Matt Harvey situation. But sometimes you get a call and you're like, oh, I don't know what they want to talk about. I had obviously 100% confidence they were calling. They wanted me to talk about Mickey Callaway.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was really interested to hear how somebody who doesn't deal in Mets stuff day to day would feel about this. And the first question I was asked was something like, what the hell is going on with your team? And, you know, I don't think that this host, I mean, obviously he was prepped for our chat, but I don't think he was a diehard Mets fan following this. And he said, like, you know, how many more embarrassments can this team have this season? And I think if you're a national sports writer or sports broadcaster who doesn't pay attention to one particular sport or team over another necessarily, and you know how bad the Mets are looking this season, I mean, I don't see how the team can lack so much shame that they don't have to address this in a more serious way. I can't imagine being the Mets and being okay with being the laughingstock of baseball.
Right. And especially as you've heard reactions that have been either quotes from other executives or press conferences that other managers have had where members of the media in those cities have dropped "see you tomorrow."
Right. Yeah.
and brought up questions about kind of that balance of being out there on the field, being a competitor, and then very quickly getting into the clubhouse and going into your public-facing mode and all that. So, but I don't know. I think this gets to the point that you brought up at the top of the show. How many times has somebody in a Mets uniform spoken to the press and had it be a thing that inspires writers who write for – I don't want to say it happened on every other team, but writers from other teams to reference it and make fun of it. And I mean, for lack of a better term, it was a bit of a meme.
Yeah. Somebody had recently said that every day there's one person who's the main character of Twitter, and it's your job as a human being to never be that person. And I feel like Mickey Callaway was the main character of Twitter on Sunday.
Yeah, I know a couple of examples of that specifically would be, I forget if it was, I think it was Lindsay Adler. It may have been Laura Albanese. The L names. It's one of the two. I think it was Lindsay who had brought up that a baseball writing friend of hers was using a dating app and got a message from someone who opened with a reference to the Mickey Callaway situation as like the first message of a conversation in that dating app. in closer proximity to my day-to-day, I know there's somebody in my office who made a reference to another diehard Mets fan I work with about the way Callaway spoke to Healy. Again, not somebody who would bring up a Mets thing to my coworker or to me. Like the only other circumstance where I had imagined that would happen, that specific conversation, would be if the Mets won the World Series.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Again, like
that magnitude. So yeah, to be the running joke, I actually, for research purposes, and I enjoy the comedy of a couple people who are on late night TV, not all of them, but I'm curious. I'd imagine I would have seen it if they referenced it, but I was a little surprised to not have seen references to it from, you know, whether it's Colbert, my personal favorite,
Seth Meyers, Conan, like there's lots of people who maybe it would have come up.
And when Jimmy Fallon's the one I don't watch, but even like whatever, I mean, like
of course you don't watch him. You have an IQ over 7.
But yeah, it was.
Sorry. I actually know some very nice people who work on his show. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's okay. I'm in a sharing mode. I insulted a writer for one of Seth Meyers' writers.
I remember this story. Yes.
in a social, not a giant social context, but just in a context where the Mets shittiness came up in a way that I just fired back with an insult that was maybe a little over the top. I wouldn't say I regretted it, but it was, you know, it was a little harsh. But yeah, there are good people writing for shows, no matter how much you enjoy them or not. But
yeah.
But yeah, I'm just surprised it didn't, because it felt like, because of the ways it came up in other parts where the Mets kind of were cultural instead of just sports, for their LOL Mets. Yeah, I'm a little surprised. Maybe I missed them, but I'm just a little surprised that there weren't lines in the monologues of the late night shows taking shots at the Mets. Yeah. And it's one thing, I love Stephen Colbert's work. I've watched the show. I've enjoyed the way he's sort of presented it and the focus it's taken on and all that. And without getting political with it, I mean, everybody knows what his show's about on a nightly basis. But I think that's one difference with that show, where if it was Letterman, there would have been at least two Mets jokes.
Oh, of course. Yes.
On Monday. Yeah. And the gravity of the situation and the approach for Colbert is just different. Given everything else that's going on. But,
What I was going to say was that maybe there's just so many horrible things happening in the world this week that, like, this gets somewhat shuffled off to the side when it comes to late night comedy.
Right.
You know, when the president basically says that he's glad a senator died, you know, you don't really focus on the Mets as much then, I guess.
Right.
So.
But they're there. They're there for comic relief.
Sure, yes.
I am somebody who has used hashtag LOL Mets sarcastically 85% of the time.
Right, of course.
And sometimes they are actually the LOL Mets. And yes. Yeah, so yeah.
I would say this week they went from even being LOL Mets to being the facepalm Mets.
Yeah.
One step beyond.
This is Kara Swisher. I want to tell you about my podcast, Recode Decode. Every week, we have candid, in-depth conversations with people like Elon Musk, Nancy Pelosi, and Kathy Griffin. We talk about how they got to where they are today and how their work is changing our world. New episodes of Recode Decode are released every Monday and Wednesday, and we often have bonus episodes on Friday. Subscribe for free to be the first to hear them on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app.
Ahoy, Mets fans. It's Brian from Amazing Avenue Audio, the show, with a quick news bulletin. My co-host, Chris McShane, recently released an album with his band, The Los Hot Quesos. It's called Hot Queso, and it is phenomenal. I had the pleasure of seeing these boys in the Bronx for the record release party on Saturday night, and it was everything you want a rock and roll show to be. The album is so great. Go to hotquesos.com and pick it up digitally or on vinyl. I recommend the vinyl. Enjoy. Hot Queso. Well, let's talk about something other than Callaway and Vargas for a minute.
Sure.
So also on this radio appearance, I was asked if I thought the Mets had a run in them. That could they put a run together and get back into relevance? And I said that I think that there are lots of pieces on the team that make you believe that's a possibility. I said, but the bullpen is so bad that I cannot see the team making a run with this bullpen as currently constructed, or even without essentially blowing it up, without having almost an entirely new collection of pitchers. I don't see it happening. Because the bullpen has just been that bad. It's been absolutely atrocious. And for a team that hasn't had a particularly good bullpen in a long time, this feels like an especially troublesome, bad, frustrating bullpen. Do you agree that no matter how good the other elements of the Mets team are, unless they make some changes in the bullpen, they have no real postseason future this year.
Yeah, and I don't see how you make those kind of changes at this point in time.
Same, yeah.
You're not going to go and trade a bunch of prospects for relievers in hopes of riding the ship. That's obviously far too risky and short-sighted. And that there aren't, you know, it's late June now. So in early June, there was one really good reliever out there who was just available for money. That's not the case anymore. So yeah, I've been obviously optimistic in general over the last few years, more so than I'd say the average Mets fan at certain points in Sandy Alderson's tenure and all that. And even I'm at a point that tonight they were up 4-0 and I was just like, that's not enough.
Yeah.
They're going to lose. And man, that kind of talk during a game, if somebody else did that to me during a game, I'd say before 2019 and maybe even before the last month, I'd hate it. I'd be like, oh, come on, like, stop. Don't dread every situation. It's not all going to end poorly. And yet here we are tonight. They're up 4-0. And I was just sitting there going,
Vargas is cruising. Like, right. He's trolling all of us how well he's pitching.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And they can't do it.
Right. So, but with all that, I'm sitting there having that thought that I would normally hate to have somebody else text to me. And it turns out to be true. It turns out it's not enough. They blow it. And I don't know. I just remember in May when people were citing how good the Mets' May bullpen ERA was.
Yes.
Yeah, that was a thing.
That was.
There was an old series on the site, Forgotten First Half, and I feel like that would be a very good item for that.
Yes. I mean, even if you try and put on the rosiest colored glasses you can and think, all right, maybe the Mets could flip both Dom Smith and Todd Frazier and Jason Vargas for some bullpen pieces. I don't know if three or four bullpen pieces are even enough. And that's crazy to say. But who do you trust in the current bullpen, Chris?
Edwin Diaz. Generally, okay. I know, sure, the talent is there.
Yep.
We spent the first couple of weeks of the season saying, like, wow, look at that fastball, look at the way it moves, look at his stuff, all that. We know what he's capable of. He has a track record. The whole approach to using him for more than an inning is ultimately what fueled the fire of everything that happened on Sunday. And it's just been weird. But as a, that's the team, that's the manager, that's the front office, that's all that. As a player, I still trust him. So that would be a situation. Mets are up 3-4 runs, or maybe even just one run, and he comes in and somebody says, the Mets are going to lose. I would still have that frustration of, come on, don't do that. This guy's good. So I still have that level of confidence in him. And then right now, that's it. And I don't know. Like, I don't know how long can we say the same thing that, well, you never know. Maybe one of these guys turns out to be good. And I never want to shit on guys who are, you know, fighting to stay in the major leagues or make it to the major leagues. I feel like that's probably one of the most vulnerable positions somebody could be in when they're being paid to play a sport. And I don't want to take that for granted, but I don't know. We've gone long enough with generally the same group of guys saying, well, maybe a couple of them turn out good or okay or even better than that, but I just don't see it. There's not it's not like it's been a new wave of guys. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, they've had, I'm looking this up as I say it, but they've had 20 different pitchers pitch in relief this year. And I don't have offhand whether or not that's way above average, way below average, but it's a lot.
It is.
It's a lot of different guys. And of the 20, three of them have an ERA below 3. One of them is Wilmer Font, who I think we...
He's ERA below 3?
It's still 2.7 right now. Two things. One, it's relief only, so the starts don't count.
Okay.
So that's part of it. And then two, were any of the runners that scored last night not his? Maybe one of them was.
I don't remember.
Yeah, I was. I followed that game on at bat on the phone, which seems like maybe I paid too much attention to it. But yeah, he gave up 3 runs in a third of an inning. I know somebody had made the joke of like, oh, you know, Wilmer Font's good for a week. Like, that's over.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And then the other two are Ryan O'Rourke, who's thrown an inning and a third.
And was DFA'd today.
Yep. And then Seth Lugo, who had a bit of a rough outing tonight. So yeah. I'd actually, let's see, did he go over 3? Yep, he sure did. So, yeah. But Lugo still, despite having had a rough week.
Yes.
He's there. Diaz and Chris Flexen and Paul Sewald, who have the latter of those three have combined to throw 14 innings. And then after that, it's you're in the mid fours and then plus and plus, plus, plus.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I still trust Diaz. Recent misfortune aside, I more or less trust Lugo.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I do with him. Yeah.
Yeah. I half trust Gazelman and Familia, and I trust no one else. And my half trust is being generous. It's just rough right now.
Yeah, it is.
We had an email about this week, not about the bullpen specifically, but about how tired they are of hearing us complain about Callaway's bullpen management. So sorry. I still think he's terrible. It's from a guy named George Hurley, who I'm really hoping is the George Hurley who drummed for the Minutemen.
Oh, that would be amazing.
If you are that Georgie Hurley, email us. We'll have you on the show.
Yeah, of course.
We'll talk about how great side two of Double Nickels on the Dime is. But we have one other email this week from our friend Ryan, and he has two questions for us. I'm just going to ask them to you, and you got to give me your gut reaction, okay?
All right.
Number one, is Cano the latest version of Robbie Alomar?
No.
Yeah, I think it's too early to say that just now.
Me too.
Yeah. There, I suppose there's a chance of that, but we're a long way away from that.
Yeah.
Especially because Robbie Alomar didn't have 5 years in his contract. So Robbie Alomar might be the preferable situation if Cano is this bad for this long, though I don't think that's going to be the case. And number two, is Dom Smith, if Dom Smith keeps hitting, is it worth keeping him around if there's a good shot at a National League designated hitter soon? I believe they said 2021 would be the earliest that would happen, correct?
Yeah.
And so, no, I don't think it's worth keeping Dom Smith for 2 seasons if you're just banking on there maybe being an NLDH in 2 years.
Yeah, that's not a reason to do that. I guess in a Mets-specific circumstance where you would expect the owners won't spend money on a DH if one comes to the National League, I could see a way of kind of twisting into that.
Sure.
And hey, the owners are the owners. That is reality. So I'm not even necessarily knocking that. But I think I think the front office, to the extent that it can, should operate in a way that is the most rational, logical, and efficient way of making the Mets win when they have that situation. And I don't think you hold on to Smith just for that. Clearly, Alonso is your starting first baseman. And I will say, maybe I've just muted enough people on Twitter, but I haven't seen anybody saying that Smith should get more of a look and start games at first base. Everybody seems to be pretty much fully on board with the fact that Alonso is really good and is clearly the starter there.
Yeah, I mean, that would just be silly.
Right, but you never know. All right. Next? Is there a next?
No, that's it. That's it.
Oh, okay.
Next is your music recommendation for this week.
Oh, okay. So I've been going back and forth a little bit, but I think I've generally preferred to stick with new stuff here. But I'll go back to an older one now. Being that we're going to Solid Sound, which is Wilco's festival in Western Massachusetts at Massmocha, happens every other summer, which is the name of a documentary they made about it. And I think it had footage from the 2013 one, maybe 15. But in that spirit, I would say, if I were to rank all their records, there's a different record that I would put first. But for me and for us, it was really Sky Blue Sky that got us hooked and got us into them. They had been a band that I had heard about quite a bit and then never really taken a dive into. And then they were playing a show at the Warsaw, which at the time and still, if they did it today, would be an insanely small show for them.
Yes.
And a couple of friends were going, had a third ticket, and somebody bailed, and day of the show reached out and said, hey, do you want to take that ticket? And that was when I kind of took the plunge. So they were touring around that record. That's what got me hooked. And then that's what had me dive into everything that came before it and be, addicted to every piece of music they put out after it. So I always find it kind of fascinating where people get in on a band. There's nothing wrong with getting in when they're on the ground floor or when they're medium-sized or huge or haven't made a record in 20 years and you just figured out that this was a thing that you might want to listen to. So in that context, Sky Blue Sky was that was my door into the Wilco world. So I'll recommend that because it did it for me.
What would be your overall favorite album of theirs?
I think Ghost is Born is probably the strongest combination, even though it doesn't have Nels Klein on guitar.
Right, but it has that really good Tweedy Lee guitar stuff.
Right, and he's underrated for that work. But yeah, that the combination of the songwriting and the instrumental sound that goes along with it, I think start to finish, it's probably the strongest. So
interesting.
Yeah.
I had heard a bunch of Wilco, like anecdotally, on mixes and the radio and whatever. But I was working in college radio and my radio station had a copy of Mermaid Avenue. And so that was the first one I had listened to, like, front to back. And then I had heard a pirated copy of Yankee Hotel Foxtrot before it was released, And then yeah. I went to go see the I'm Trying to Break Your Heart documentary at the Art House Theater in Pittsburgh when I was living there. And that was what turned me into, a super fan.
Yeah, nice.
I feel like there's a case to be made for almost every Wilco album as being sort of the best one, but I think I'm a super normie, and we'll just say Yankee Hotel Foxtrot's still my favorite.
Okay.
I've listened to Sky Blue Sky a lot lately. I've been really into the last song on Wilco Records lately.
Okay.
And I think On and On and On might be the best one.
Okay. Magnetized is up there for me.
Okay. I could see that.
There might be a bias given the connection there, but
the co-writing credit there?
Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah. But yeah. I forget. I've seen them 30 something times now. I might be getting into 40 this weekend. I could tell you if I open my spreadsheet, and because I have one of all the shows I've been to since I started doing it, at least. There was a show they opened, and somewhere, it's not up to date at the moment, but there is somewhere where I have a spreadsheet of all the set lists they've played in all these shows, so I can do pivot tables in Excel and figure out which songs I've heard how many times.
I mean, I do that for Ween shows, so I understand.
Yeah. Actually, no. I think this weekend will be shows Piazza and... I guess Matt's would be the current. I can't think of a better 32. Wait, did Henry Mejia wear 32?
I am so bad with player numbers.
All right, let's find out. But I think the last time we had seen them was the last Solid Sound. And then it was kind of neat that was the 30th show happened.
Sure, yeah.
During that. So anyway, I've seen them a bunch of times. At one of the shows, they opened with On and On and On.
Oh, that's interesting.
Which is, you know, it's... I don't want to say it's totally sad and depressing, because I think there's a message in that song that is taking that subject and trying to make it not be that.
Agreed.
But, you know, there's this uplifting message to the topic. But... as an opener, it sets a different tone than Absolutely. Maybe your standard show. So yeah,
I'm trying to figure out. I know I was at a Wilco show at the Wellmont Theater in 2010. They played two nights there. I'm trying to see which one. Oh, this was definitely the one I was at. Okay, did they do On and On and On? They did not that night. Can't remember. That was a great show though. But so for my pick, I was going to pick the Los Hot Quesos, who I saw in concert on Saturday night.
But, yeah.
But I already made a commercial that aired during the show about that album, so I figured it'll be overkill to put a second commercial for that album in here. So
fair enough. I won't object.
So I've been debating with some friends recently. There's a band that the three of us really, really love, and it's a band that I think has a really impeachably strong discography, and so we've been ranking their albums, and that band is the New Pornographers.
Okay.
And so I've been just like in a text chain with two friends debating this back and forth, and so I've been thinking a lot about the New Pornographers, and so I'm going to pick their second album, 2003's The Electric Version, and it's their most like straightforward rock and roll record. Almost every song is like a driving electric guitar song, and it has, I think, their best song on it, which is called Testament to Youth in Verse. And they're a band that has two songwriters. The one songwriter writes like literally 2/3 of the songs, if not 3/4 of the songs, and they have a guy who writes 3 songs an album. And that guy's name is Dan Behar. He's also in a band called Destroyer. And Testament to Youth in Verse is a Behar song. It's incredible. It's my favorite song of theirs. It's in probably my top 10 songs of all time in general. But this album is just like pure power pop, really strong songs. Nico Case is one of the vocalists in the band. So you get amazing vocals, really strong hooks, some incredible drumming from the drummer Kurt Dahl, who is no longer with the band but was still with the band in 2003. Maybe one of my favorite drummers of all time. I fantasize about like hitting the lottery and getting him to play on an album I write, because his drumming is just, it's the best. But yeah, you can't go wrong with any song on this album. It's 13 songs, and I think there's only like two songs that I wouldn't have glowing things to say about on it. It's super fun. And it also, it's one of those albums, and I'm sure that you have albums like this, everyone who's listening to this, but this came out like in between my junior and senior year of college. And so I have a lot of memories of just having a lot of fun while this album was playing. You know, just that was a very happy time in my life. And, yeah, I lived in a great apartment with two friends, and we had this album on a lot that year. So there are memories that are like inextricably tied to this album that I can't separate. But it's fantastic. The Electric Version by The New Pornographers. So, Chris, if any of our listeners are at Solid Sound, should they come get your autograph on a new Hot Quesos record?
Sure. Ooh, I'll probably have some in my trunk.
There you go.
For the record, we didn't set up an autograph station. People just started asking. So
yeah,
who are we to deny somebody's happiness or whatever that cliche is?
Absolutely.
But yeah, no, it's it'll be interesting. We actually we went to a like in somebody's house kind of show that is open to the public in Freehold, New Jersey, called the Concerts in the Studio. And you know, it's not something that gets publicized and all that. They don't have that hard of a time filling the room, but it is something that you can be tuned into and you can just go as anybody and be there. So, what was my point? I had a point.
Autographs.
So, oh, yeah, yeah, and then just the whole Solid Sound thing. So, right, so we go, and three of the members of Wilco had some side project stuff that they're doing, and we saw that show there and everything. And I'm actually curious to see how many people who were in that room, because pretty much everybody who would go to a house show on a Sunday night in New Jersey of half the band is in on the level that they're going to be at this festival.
Right. Yeah.
So pretty much everybody in the room was like, see, it's Odd Sound. And I'm wondering in a couple of days, how many of those faces I'm going to remember specifically.
Right.
And how many moments of just like, hey, I mean, like names, of course, that's out the window. No, nobody should remember each other's names from any of these interactions, but it's going to be the place of, okay, did I see this person a few months ago at that house, or did I talk to them at like the last Solid Sound, or there was a guy I had a conversation with about Solid Sounds at a Slater Kinney show at Irving Plaza when they did their like shrinking tour. At the end of the year, they did their comeback. What was that, 2017, I think, maybe 16, but whatever, yeah, whatever year it was. So yeah, I'm going to be curious about that, but I will say that my wife has been not shy at all. Whereas I'm not saying I wouldn't bring up the fact that, okay, I'm in a band and we made a record and it came out last week. I'm not opposed to doing that, but my wife is much less shy about it. And I appreciate that. I love that it is just like, it's nice to have somebody who will just kind of not have your own apprehension about your own work and say, oh, hey, if you like this, you'd like his record. And it just came out and all that. So yeah, we'll throw some in the trunk. They might all come home with us. That's okay. But we just want to have them there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's cool when you're a super fan of a band and you get to know their fans and you just like recognize people at shows and that, and it's really fun. It's really satisfying until you bring an outsider with you to one of those shows and you try to explain like, oh, I don't really know that guy. I've just seen him at 25 shows. And they're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. You know, so then yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I had that with Mission to Burma for a little bit. It's actually been a long time. I wonder what that guy's up to. Don't remember his name. Like five or six shows in a row. And the funny thing is my cousin and I went to all those shows except one, but we went to all those shows together over a long span of time. And it would just be like, hey, how's it going, man? Whatever kind of exchange. But I I knew that guy because I had seen him in that context so many times.
Yeah, there was yeah, I have a lot of stories like that. there was a period of time where I was seeing the Pixies or Frank Black like every possible time I could, and there are friendships that I've made that like extended to like Facebook friendships and all that. They're just from these random people who we just have like a band we love in common. So that's always cool. Anyway, enjoy Solid Sound.
Thank you.
I'm jealous. I have a verbal commitment from my wife that we will take the kids next time.
All right.
Because my kids are still, I think my son is still too young to enjoy that, you know, to be able to do it for more than like a couple of hours. So, you know, next time.
Yeah. For sure. Hey, I like it.
But, you know, until then, go to AmazingAvenue.com. Check out everything we have going on there. There's lots more Mickey Callaway analysis because we know you need more of that. We've got, game recaps, news, lots of stuff on the minor leagues. So check it all out there. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Amazing Avenue. You can get this show from Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. You can find me and Chris on Twitter. He's Chris McShane. I'm at Brian Needs a Nap. And until next time, let's go Mets.
Are you troubled by strange hockey trades in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread about NHL free agency?
Have you or your family ever seen a New York Islanders game?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Pick up your mobile device and subscribe to Lighthouse Hockey Podcast from SB Nation today.
Our courteous and efficient hosts are ready to serve all of your Islander needs and worries.
Lighthouse Hockey Podcasts for New York Islanders fans.
This week on Switched on Pop, there's a new version of Aladdin in theaters, and people are not having it. They are upset about the new live-action version of Prince Ali, as sung by Will Smith. But maybe not for the reasons you'd expect. Charlie and I break down the musical differences between the 1992 original and this new live-action version to understand why, whether you know it or not, everyone is a music theorist. I'm musicologist Nate Sloan. Subscribe to Switched on Pop wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll see you every Tuesday.